Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
For more in-depth perspectives and interesting stories, sign up for our daily newsletter at tvo.org/daily.
It can sound like science fiction, but what's known as algorithmic policing is already in use in Ontario. A camera reads your license plate going through a red light, for example. But that may change as police forces consider expanding the use of technology, perhaps even to do what's called predictive policing. A recent report from the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab raised some red flags about where it could go wrong. With us for a closer look, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Ryan Prox, an adjunct professor at Simon Fraser University School of Criminology and officer in charge of crime analytics for Vancouver's police department. And the co-authors of that report in Ottawa, Cynthia Koo, research fellow at the Citizen Lab and a technology and human rights lawyer. And in downtown Toronto, Kate Robertson, a criminal lawyer at Marks and Law and a research fellow at U of T's Citizen Lab. Welcome all.
Happy to be here.
So,
thank you.
This is a, sounds pretty advanced, sounds like it's out of, you know, out of a movie. Cynthia, what is algorithmic policing?
Algorithmic policing is our term to encompass a wide range of technologies, which generally speaking use mass data processing in order to draw inferences to inform policing decisions, or alternatively to automate surveillance at a scale unprecedented to us before.
Kate, I'm going to bring you in here. What could that look like when we talk about algorithmic policing?
Well, algorithmic technology, when used in policing, tends to turn traditional methods of policing on their head by either extrapolating case-specific surveillance activities to a massive scale to capture wide segments of the population who may, or in all likelihood, are not under any type of active investigation or suspicion of wrongdoing. Or alternatively, another type of technology called predictive policing is trying to, sometimes with mixed success or unsuccess, draw patterns from historic police data in order to predict where or when or who may be involved with future crime that may not ever happen.
Now, Ryan, you're a police officer yourself. How does this technology differ from traditional police methods?
There's a bit of miscommunication and a bit of sensationalism that comes to bear when we're talking about predictive, or I don't like to use the term predictive. I prefer to use the term crime forecasting when you're talking about making specifically geospatial forecasts of areas. So when we talk about crime forecasting, what we're talking about is police have been doing what's been called hotspot policing for 30, 40 years. It's basically in the old, before the day of computers, you used to put pins on a map, evolved to computers, kind of did hotspots, which is the, like a color-coded intensity of where crime is. And crime forecasting is kind of the next evolution of that, where instead of using yesterday's data, where we look at what happened yesterday and we're going to try and deploy our police resources tomorrow, we're looking at what's happening almost in a real-time scenario and try and allocate the resources more efficiently and effectively. So there's no kind of minority report component to it. It's just a more efficient use of police resources, which is a citizen, I'd like to see the police being deployed more effectively.
Now, Kate, you write in your report that the historical and social context in the criminal justice system is important in understanding this type of policing. How come?
Well, actually, I very much agree with Ryan that sometimes this type of technology is mislabeled. And in some respects, it's not a new proposition to deploy police resources to for example, neighborhoods on a proactive basis in the hopes of somehow deterring crime. But what we've called attention to in our report is that there, the law enforcement services in Canada have also been associated with discriminatory practices that has resulted in the overrepresentation of marginalized groups, racialized communities, and Indigenous communities in policing data. And so what our concern in the introduction of algorithms into this dynamic is that it can perpetuate these types of discriminatory biases under a scientific veneer that really hides what's going on and can result in the continuation of adverse effects through proactive policing that are already being communities.
I want to pick up on that. Cynthia, how do you have any examples of what those fears may look like when we talk about algorithmic policing discriminating against marginalized communities?
Sure. We have no shortage of examples when it comes to this sort of discrimination from looking at other jurisdictions, most particularly the United States. For example, we know of predictive policing programs happening in Chicago with the Chicago Police Department strategic subject list and in the Los Angeles Police Department with Operation Laser, both of which, it's really worth noting, have been shut down within the past 1 or 2 years due to finding that they weren't effective, that they had questionable data practices, that there wasn't enough oversight. And what we saw happening with these programs was that police were being sent disproportionately to Black and Latinx communities, for example, to other marginalized communities. Other examples involve risk assessment algorithms, which purport to predict whether someone is likely or not to engage in future crime, regardless of whether that actually happens or not. So probably the most well-known example is the COMPASS algorithm used in the corrections context in the United States, which ProPublica found, I think, falsely flagged Black defendants at almost twice the rate of white defendants. So I would echo Kate in saying that we actually agree with Ryan when it comes to the language, and we actually try to move towards the language of forecasting in our report, because predictive policing, in some way, it's a marketing term by the vendors of this sort of technology, mm-hmm. and it does overstate the level of certainty and knowledge that this software can actually give. And so it's trying to find that balance between moving to what we think is more accurate way of talking about this technology and also using the term that unfortunately to some extent has been popularized so people know what we're talking about. But at the end of the day, it doesn't change what's actually happening, which is using algorithms to draw statistical generalized inferences for the purposes of making criminal justice decisions about specific individuals.
Now, Ryan, Cynthia mentioned our neighbors to the south, the U.S., you know, for some examples of using that technology. We can also look at countries like China. How does Canada differ from their use of technology from those countries?
And that's a really important point. Most of the points that Cynthia brought up in regards to the American context, I actually agree with the concerns and the issues that have cropped up in the States. But within the Canadian milieu, we've very much been watching what's been happening there and been trying to avoid a lot of the pitfalls and shortcomings that the Americans, Operation Laser and LAPD, that it spurned a grassroots organization called Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, which was very instrumental in getting the laser program abolished. So within the Canadian context, I don't see as much of a parallel. We don't have the same militarization of the police in Canada. We have more of a community-based approach versus what you see in the United States. As well, we have a different legislative and oversight framework in Canada. We have, for example, privacy commissioners throughout each province, and the privacy commissioners take a very keen eye to any activities that the police engage in where they're doing any sort of data collection or using data in an aggregate level. As well as the federal government, back in April of 2019, they implemented the automated data processing directive, which only applies to federal government entities, but it does put a framework for doing a risk assessment. They have the automated impact or the algorithmic impact assessment framework, which evaluates the veracity of the algorithms themselves, looks for inherent biases, and requires the vendor to actually submit their algorithms to the federal government technical specialist for review. So we do have a different environment in Canada than where it's more the Wild West in the States.
So I'm curious, this may sound like a foolish question here. It's used in the States, it's used in countries like China, we're starting to use it in Canada. But Kate, is any of this legal?
Well, sometimes when it comes to the question of legality, you're talking about a moving target. It has to be that way for a good reason, because our human rights law and our constitution by design has to keep up and remain meaningful despite a changing technological landscape. But what we've called attention to is that some of the big ticket questions, like is this technology creating intrusive impacts on privacy in Canada? Is it discriminatory? There are significant questions that remain unanswered, and we do have a number of findings that suggest that some uses of this technology is incompatible with our Constitution. But we've also called attention to the need for bringing the oversight system in Canada into the 21st century. And from a question of legality, sometimes the very absence of oversight and regulatory oversight can create an illegal situation. And so I have to actually disagree with Ryan that Canada has a meaningful level of check and balance when it comes to controversial and experimental technologies in Canada. Too often we're seeing that police services view some of the oversight mechanisms as optional and discretionary, and the public learns about controversial technology being deployed long after the fact, when really the public does have a right to know. It's a matter of public concern, and they may have an opportunity and a value add in providing input on what kind of regulations are needed to supervise very controversial technologies. And if I could put it in contrast, from a real perspective, when you're talking about big data techniques, Canada's national security institutions are actually more regulated than police services in Canada, which quite frankly makes no sense.
I want to pick up on that with Ryan. Do we know, do police use this technology to arrest, charge, and have we gotten convictions out of this?
Well, I would argue that we look at, there's different subsets within algorithmic policing. If you look at it from a predictive policing or forecasting, as I mentioned, it basically deploys the police in a more efficient use. If you look at more of the risk areas, such as artificial intelligence or machine learning enabled technologies like facial recognition, that's something where within the Canadian context, that's very, very limited applications. And it's considered a very high risk area for law enforcement to go into. And I don't see that we're using the tech. We're very circumspect on how we use the technology in Canada because of the inherent risks on it. And I do foresee what the federal government has done, and the Treasury Board specifically with the automated decision-making directive in April of 2019. I do see that kind of as a framework of moving forward to give greater oversight at the provincial level. So provincial law enforcement and other provincial government entities themselves will have some sort of guidelines and best practices in place, because to be candid, that isn't in existence. We have guidelines and we do look to the federal government to adhere to them, but there is no provincial legislative framework that has an enforcement provision. So I think that's something that I agree with my learned colleagues. That's something that should move forward and be in place and kind of have clearer lines of engagement for how police should use more advanced technology.
Cynthia, is there any concern that this technology will be used to surveil people who are just living their lives?
Absolutely. That is one of our main sources of concern, that this technology will be used in an overbroad and overreaching way to survey people living their lives, or especially to survey people who are trying to improve their rights through seeking equality and civil rights, for example. We know when it comes to social media surveillance, particularly, for example, that the Canadian law enforcement has a track record of surveilling different types of social movements. For example, Cindy Blackstock, a First Nations human rights defender, was found to have had her social media profile spied on by the federal government. We know that the RCMP was using Social Studio in a project known as Project Wide Awake to survey people for around 2 years before the public found out, due to the Tai breaking that story. Similarly, we know that the Toronto Police Services was using facial recognition again for over a year before the public knew, again, due to media breaking that story. And so it's that concern of turning our public forums of expression, whether that's virtual forums such as social media, or public physical forums such as attending protests, that we are concerned about the surveillance risk. And we know this happens because the vendors themselves, for example, Media Sonar, which is based in London, Ontario, was banned from Twitter and Facebook and Instagram because it was promoting its services for policing, for surveilling Black Lives Matter hashtags on social media to police mm-hmm. services, for example. And the RCMP has said that they want to use social media to engage in proactive monitoring, which again is predictive or forecasting. It's not in the context of an ongoing investigation where crime has already happened. So there's something particularly pernicious about the idea that by virtue of being a marginalized group actively engaged in trying to fight for your equality and civil rights, you might bring that sort of police scrutiny upon you when someone else might not, which of course would be a violation of the rights to freedom of expression.
I want to talk about the Vancouver Police Department. They use a program called GeoDash. Ryan, can you tell us what does that program do?
It's the next evolution of hotspot policing. So it forecasts residential break and enters 24 hours in advance, gives 2-hour intervals where it forecasts 6 locations that have a higher probability. I hazard to say predictions, but a higher probability of encountering an incident. So with that, we can deploy our resources or notify through BlockWatch neighborhoods that are at a higher risk factor identified within a 2-hour interval that there's a greater potential for them to encounter a property crime incident, like such as residential break and enters. Having said that, you know, I think it is important to mention we don't use police generated data. We've gone to significant lengths to kind of hedge against a lot of the things that Cynthia is bringing up that have been identified in the US as problematic. So we only use citizen generated data. So if you call and report that your house was burglarized, we use that data. If a police officer identifies through proactive enforcement that there's some sort of nefarious or criminal activity, we exclude that from the algorithm to at least hedge against algorithmic bias seeping into the system. As well, we have exclusionary zones for forecasting around sensitive areas. For example, our downtown east side, we have an exclusionary zone because it's considered one of the more marginalized communities in the city of Vancouver. So we don't deploy resources within those areas based on crime forecasting. We have specialized units that deal with community outreach within the downtown east side. So there's no net benefit to overlapping that with crime forecasting.
Now, has the program led to a reduction in crime?
Significant. During our 6-month pilot project, we saw reductions month over month between 5 to 27% reductions in property crime with our deployed resources being proactively engaged with the forecasting locations. Put that in context, typical traditional policing proactive measures, if we see reductions of 5%, we consider that a high success. Having reductions of 21 to 27%, which we saw in some of the summer months, is unheard of. So we did see significant improvements and reductions in residential break and enters when the program was piloted.
Now, Cynthia, I want to ask you about a little bit about transparency and putting this report together. How open are police about using this technology with the public, and what was that process like putting the report together?
Well, it really ran across the gamut, depending on the particular police department or federal or provincial department that we were speaking to. Some departments, like Ryan and the VPD, were actually quite forthcoming with us, and others, mostly police services in Ontario, I'd have to say, were almost the complete opposite. With respect to filing freedom of information requests, for example, we ran into multiple barriers in trying to obtain information and details, whether it was extraordinarily high processing fees. For example, one service quoted us about $9,000 to process that freedom of information request, which we couldn't proceed with. Others claimed various statutory exceptions, whether it was third-party commercial interest, cabinet confidentiality, for example. There were long processing delays. So I think the RCMP told us that it would be about two years before they could fulfill our request. So needless to say, that information did not make it into our report. The Alberta Ministry of Justice told us that they found some 200 pages of information that were responsive to our request, but they were withholding them because of, again, statutory exemptions. So there's just all this information out there. To the extent that we know our report, what's in there is really the tip of the iceberg. And that's why one of our first recommendations is to call for full disclosure and transparency on the part of police agencies across Canada, so we actually know what the full factual landscape is and then can make those critical legal policy and regulatory decisions based on knowing the facts.
So the report has been out for a month. What's the reaction been so far from law enforcement?
Well, in some ways, it's very early to be able to see what the reaction has been. I mean, in some ways, we've already known going into this report and the research stages that law enforcement representatives, including Ryan and others, are cognizant of the human rights dangers that are at stake. But nevertheless, we've called attention to the fact that we need more information than sort of the basic fact that this algorithm is being used or not in order to discern its human rights effects. And so, for example, when you insert an algorithm into a complex social problem, it can be sometimes difficult to discern what's happening and why. So Ryan had mentioned a few moments ago that crime statistics had been declining during the pilot project of the Vancouver algorithm. However, generally, nationwide in Canada over the last 20 years, we saw year after year declines in property crime rates generally. So it's hard to know whether that's larger forces at work or the algorithm itself. The same kind of context is needed for the human rights impacts. And where we differ with from some of our colleagues in law enforcement who are experimenting with these technologies is that it may not be possible to actually mitigate the use of an algorithm in order to prevent the human rights dangers. And so when we've seen that potentially there may or may not be an effect, a positive effect with the use of algorithm, but we do know that proactive policing in community does cause adverse effects for particularly youth and racialized communities. Proactive detentions and stops in the communities have been linked to mental health adverse effects, employment effects, and other larger social harm regarding the deterioration of the relationship between police and communities. So there are important questions that still do need to be answered, and we look forward to continuing to see the report attract public attention about the call for need for regulation and clear limits.
Ryan, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that response there.
Well, there's quite a bit there. I would argue that about 3 years ago, just as a criminologist, we saw most property crime and violent crime kind of hit rock bottom. And generally speaking, in Canada, we've seen that starting to ramp back up again. There's been incremental increases across the board in violent crime, offenses against the person, and property crime. So I would argue that that downward 20 to 30 year trend that we've been seeing, and for the most part, law enforcement has taken a lot of credit for that, it's been inching upward again. In terms of the transparency and accountability, I couldn't agree with that more. I think one of the biggest issues is that a lot of these things are not done with full disclosure to the public. That's something with the Vancouver Police we've made great effort to try and address. For example, we've had town hall meetings. I've given presentations at the BC Civil Liberties Association on the use of the technology. So they weren't finding out about it within the community by freedom of information request by the media. We actually got out and proactively engaged with the community, announced what we were doing, and were available to present on that and answer questions to try and alleviate any fears. Because a lot of people, when they think of this technology, they might think of Minority Report or kind of science fiction movies. And I actually think what's happening with the report that's currently out is that it engages a discussion around a topic that usually is kind of sidelined and not foremost in people's minds. And there's a lot of unknowns and disinformation around that. So having a dialogue around this topic, I think, is extremely important. And equally important, I agree with my learned colleagues that we should have some sort of regulatory framework that just sets up the rules of engagement so that everybody's operating on the same page. And there's an accountability metric in place so that there's no potential or perceptions that the police are doing anything nefarious with the technology.
And with that, I think that's where we're going to have to leave it for today. But I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. That is Cynthia Koo, Kate Robertson, and Ryan Prox. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is brought to you by the Chartered Professional Accountants of Ontario. CPA Ontario is a regulator, an educator, a thought leader, and an advocate. We protect the public. We advance our profession. We guide our CPAs. We are CPA Ontario. And by viewers like you. Thank you.